Welcome to today's insight session, Back to the Future, Thriving in a World of Digital Disruption. Today, Jenna and Scott will be discussing the topic of whether insurers have the ability to use the existing frameworks to deal with changing risk profiles and trends to limit the financial impact of the unexpected before it is too late. Three key technological developments will be discussed today, including driverless cars, cyber insurance, and the Internet of Things, all of which have the potential to significantly impact the future of the general insurance industry. Jenna and Scott have a keen interest in technology, its impact on society, and what this may mean for the future of the general insurance industry. Between them, Scott and Jenna have experience across a range of general insurance areas, including pricing, reserving, portfolio monitoring, and capital management. Jenna is Executive Manager of the Capital and Reinsurance Reporting and Forecasting at Suncorp. Scott is a Senior Actuary at Taylor Fry, specialising in self-insurance and capital modelling. Please join me in welcoming Scott and Jenna.
Good afternoon and welcome to Back to the Future, Thriving in a World of Digital Disruption. Technology has impacted all our lives. It's changed the opportunities available for individuals, for businesses, and for society. However, with these opportunities have also come new risks, and this is going to be the focus of our presentation today. We're going to begin by presenting an overview of the current general insurance industry. We're then going to go on to discuss the changing role of the insurer, and this is going to help frame a lot of what we discuss later on when we outline the three technological developments. Thirdly, we're going to present some information on driverless cars, cyber risk, and the Internet of Things. And finally, we are going to give our views on how to thrive or survive in this new world. The presentation will go for approximately 40 minutes, and there'll be plenty of time for questions and a discussion at the end. So firstly, industry snapshot. The top chart on this slide plots gross written premium, the black series, and profit, the green series, by quarter. And this information is taken from APRA's quarterly statistics. And there are a few key points to note here. Firstly, gross written premium for direct insurers has increased by approximately 5% per annum since 2006. And significantly, there's been no growth since 2003 for reinsurers. Profit over this period has averaged at around $1 billion per quarter, and significantly, there's been zero growth. Profit for the industry for the year ending 31 December 2015 was lower than in the year prior, and that's due to two main factors: increased pressure on premium rates and increase in gross incurred claims due to householders and fire and ISR classes of business. What about how the industry has changed across time in relation to gross written premium? And I ask you to focus on the bottom chart here to the right. And what this does is it breaks down gross written premium by class of business across 5 years. And there's two key points that I'd like to make here. Number one is that the composition by industry, by class of business, has remained relatively stable across the last 5 years. And the second is that the blue series there represents insurance related to motor vehicles, and it accounts for approximately 40% of the industry at present. I won't spend too much time on this slide, but it displays the gross loss ratio by class of business and for the industry for direct insurers. The impact of the 2011 catastrophe experience is apparent, but the other point worth noting is that there's been an upwards trend in the loss ratio across time. I'd like to now hand over to Jenna, who is going to discuss the changing role of the insurer.
Okay, so basically what we've done on this slide is tried to think of really some generalizations about the traditional roles of insurers. So this obviously won't suit all insurers in the market, but it's really just a collection of some of the most salient points for our conversations for the rest of the pack. So the first thing that we've pointed out is that typically, traditionally, insurers have really only responded in the event of a loss. So the relationship has largely been around the transaction of money on the event of a loss, and that's really the only time the insurers have been overly involved with their customers. Product design to date has been fairly rigid. So there's been limited tailoring of products to suit the different needs of different insureds. Thirdly, we've seen limited contact with the customer. So historically, insureds have interacted with the insurer on renewal, on underwriting, and on claims. But during the middle of the policy term, not much conversation really happens back and forth. We do note, however, that this is starting to change, particularly with the advent of things such as weather alert SMSs. So you might have seen the ad that's on at the moment with the old lady hanging out the washing. So we are seeing some more increasing interactions in that space. And the last one is that in an increasingly interconnected world, we're not really seeing global activity as a key cornerstone of insurer decisions and focus at the moment. While it's still considered, I would argue that probably we're all acting with more of a localized focus and then considering global ramifications rather than the other way around. So in the remainder of this presentation, we're going to discuss how the technological disruptions will start to change this paradigm and how we may see those roles changing over time. So with that in mind, we're going to talk through three different technological developments, as we've spoken about earlier. So driverless cars being the first of those, and Scott will take you through that.
So it appears Mr. Bean was on top of driverless cars well before Google. Thatcham Research, the UK motor insurer's automotive research centre, outlines four distinct phases in the move to driverless cars. And they've also made predictions on when we will reach these milestones. At present, we are in a phase termed limited response. And this means that vehicles are able to respond to their environment in a limited set of circumstances. So they're able to apply brakes and stay in the lane at present. But significantly, the driver is required to keep the hands on the wheel. Phase two, regulations permit hands-off driving for a few minutes, and they predict that we'll be there in around 2 years' time. So you'll be able to check your email, check Instagram, check Facebook, but the car will respond and will ask you to place your hands back on the wheel after a few minutes and take control. They predict we will have fully autonomous vehicles in society in about 5 years' time. And significantly, this means that legislation will have had to have changed and adapted to autonomous cars, and sensors will have to be able to build up a complete and highly accurate picture of the world around them. And finally, they think we'll reach the destination in around 9 years' time. And this is when cars will have full connectivity with each other, and infrastructure and car sharing will become far more prolific. What are some of the current challenges associated with driverless vehicle technology? In order for them to become a commercial reality, we firstly need improvements in software and hardware. So a computer crash in the context of a driverless car could result in a physical crash. We need more detailed maps and a system in place to deal with changes in the environment. We need better sensors. Currently, driverless cars are unable to differentiate between a newspaper on the road and a newborn baby. This is obviously highly undesirable. And secondly, driverless cars need to be able to anticipate other road users' actions. And this is not really just contained to other driverless cars, but also other road users, cyclists and pedestrians. And at the moment, humans do a reasonably good job at anticipating this, but it's not perfect. Security needs to be paramount. And this picture here is of a Jeep that was hijacked in 2015. It was part of a controlled hack, received quite significant media attention, and this facilitated the recall of 1.4 million Jeeps. In the context of driverless cars, unauthorized access is highly undesirable. There needs to be legislation in place that deals with licensing and establishing fault in the case of an accident. South Australia is the first Australian state to pass legislation around driverless cars, and they have allowed testing of driverless cars on the road. And finally, ethical decision making. And on that note, I have a question for you, or a scenario that I would like you to consider. Imagine you were driving down a two-lane road at 90 kilometres an hour, and a car is coming head-on towards you. There are only two possible actions you can take. One is you drive straight ahead and hit the oncoming car, potentially sacrificing your own life. The second option is you can swerve and avoid this oncoming car, but you have to swerve into a group of pedestrians on the footpath. Can I have a show of hands? Who would choose the heroic option one? No one. No one's that brave. Who would choose option two? The bulk of people are undecided. That's good. What about if I told you that the pedestrians on the sidewalk were all over 90 years of age and they were part of a 90-year-old walking club? Would your response change? I guess going forward, technology will have to make these decisions for us, and as a society, we have to be comfortable with the decisions made. Who are the key players in this space? Google have received a lot of attention regarding autonomous cars, and they started developing driverless cars in 2009, and they began on-road testing in 2012. And that on-road testing is still carrying on to this day. Tesla have added autopilot to their top-end models of late. Ford is rumored to be in discussions with Google regarding a joint venture. Ford would develop software and systems for automotive components, and Google would focus on the master self-driving software. Apple has not said anything publicly yet about developing driverless technology, although they are currently developing an electric car, and I note the keyword publicly there. Uber is researching driverless car technology, and this would give it a significant advantage if it was able to successfully enter this space and combine it with their app. So the conclusion that we can come to here is that we're seeing technology companies shaping traditional markets. They're not just participating in traditional markets, but they're actually shaping them. So existing car manufacturers will either have to partner with technology companies going forward, develop their own internal expertise, or buy the technology from a third party if this is indeed an option. Google has recently been in the news about how much they spend on innovation. Apple. Apple has spent $5 billion on additional research and development from 2013 to 2015. And to give this some form of context, traditional car manufacturers have on average spent under $200 million over the same period of time. So there is a real risk for traditional car manufacturers being left behind. In addition, Apple recently invested $1 billion in a ride-hailing startup, and Morgan Stanley are quoted as saying the signals an interest in shared rather than owned vehicles. And this investment is forecast to be a significant revenue stream for Apple going forward. $400 billion, their forecast, by 2030. By comparison, the current iPhone generates approximately $150 billion per year. And very significantly, Warren Buffett is reported to have invested $1 billion in Apple in the first quarter of 2016. What are the implications for society? Car sharing becomes far more likely in a driverless car world. Infrastructure use, if vehicles are able to communicate with each other, they can be packed on roads more closely and use the existing infrastructure more efficiently. Reduction in accident frequency. Driver error will be replaced with technological error. And logistics has significant implications for the transportation of goods. We should see, if drivers are not required, a significant reduction in the cost required to transport goods across the country. And in addition, driverless trucks don't need to sleep, so they can operate 24 hours or close to 24 hours a day. An interesting statistic that we came across when we put this presentation together was around trucks and their involvement in fatal accidents. And in the US, trucks travel approximately 6% of all US miles, but they're involved in close to 10% of all driving fatalities. So driverless trucks could see a significant reduction in roadside fatalities. The photo in the background is actually of a convoy of self-driving trucks that made their way across Europe to the Netherlands. So this is actually far closer than may be expected. What are the implications for insurers? Fault, who is deemed responsible in the case of an accident? If it's the owner, a conventional motor vehicle insurance policy should respond. Manufacturer, product liability, but there will also be implications for fault-based CTP schemes. Systemic events, what is the impact on claim frequency and claim severity? At present, we have a high claim frequency, low average claim severity environment, and technology, or driverless technology, will flip this around. Data, how will this be captured and used? We'll be able to get a sort of a complete picture on how the car is used and the vehicle, where it travels and at what time. And premiums. We saw on the first slide that motor vehicle related insurance accounts for close to 40% of industry gross written premium. Will the industry be able to respond to this in an effective way? Agenda is going to present cyber insurance.
So I'm sure that many of us have probably heard about cyber attacks. That's not news. But I think what Scott and I found really interesting when we were researching this section was the absolute magnitude of losses that can result from cyber attacks. So in one paper, we saw that they've estimated that the economic impact of losses due to cyber attacks could be somewhere between $13 billion right up to $226 billion. And that's just a huge potential market for insurers to take advantage of, in my opinion. So what we've got on this slide is a number of the risks and the associated losses to do with cyber risks. So I think many of you will have seen them before, things like hacking, data loss, business interruption when your systems are down. But I think that one thing that we really thought about was the fact that what if a company or an individual just wants to stay off the grid? What if they don't want to even participate in the cyber world? I'm sure many of us have considered it, but what are the ramifications of that? And I think that it's important to note that that probably carries its own risks with it as well. So while you may be off the grid, there is also a risk that your competitors or other businesses are starting to get better at being connected, at better service offerings. They're more efficient. Potentially, they could reduce their costs. So imagine if you were at uni and you were sitting one of those really long essays that luckily wasn't actuarial, and you couldn't use a computer and you couldn't use the internet. You'd instantly just be behind the eight ball compared to all of your other peers. So I think that it's interesting to note that in some ways, this technical disruption affects you whether you partake in that technical world or not. Okay, so I'm now just going to take you through
two of the many current cyber breach examples that are currently flooding our newspapers. So the first one is Unioil. Oh, I knew I'd do that. Anyway, Unioil. So basically what happened with Unioil was that initially there was some data theft. So 40 gigabytes of emails and documents were stolen from Unioil. The bad thing for Unioil, apart from obviously the loss of their data, was that they hadn't been operating overly on the right side of the law. And as a result, they got blackmailed. So what happened was that they had been pretty much just paying bribes to people to try and get some oil licenses, which they probably shouldn't be doing. So the hackers ended up blackmailing Unioil. But it gets worse. So there was a leak to the media. So the media were told about Unioil's shady dealings, but they actually didn't know about the fact that Unioil were also being blackmailed at the time. So you can imagine the news articles were making Unioil out to be a terrible company, which arguably I suppose I shouldn't have done what they did, but they've completely misled the public on the fact that there was no blackmail element. So as a result, you really got reputational losses for both Unioil and Fairfax, the media company who published these articles. So I think that just goes to show that you can have quite widespread ramifications from a cyber breach. It's not necessarily the initial data loss, but there's a whole sort of fallout that carries on long after the incident. So the moral is protect your data, and if you're doing something wrong or hiding something, maybe protect it twice. I don't recommend doing something wrong, though. Disclaimer. So the second one is probably something that you're quite familiar with. I'm assuming a lot of you probably have a LinkedIn profile and have been following along with this with some interest. So what happened was in 2012, it was estimated that 6.5 million encrypted passwords were hacked from LinkedIn. These were then posted on a forum for everybody to see. So if you're a little bit lazy or not very inventive with your passwords and you tend to double up, that can obviously have quite widespread ramifications just outside of LinkedIn. So what's happened in the 4 years since is that actually they think it was closer to 117 million passwords that were hacked. So what this means, I suppose, for us is that it demonstrates that it can be very difficult to estimate the impact of cyber, and in fact it's taken 4 years and they're still not exactly sure they've got them all. Where those passwords have shown up, I mean, people know sort of where they've found them, but who knows exactly how widespread they've been shared. So the moral is keep your security measures up to date. The encryptions should be cutting edge. You should always have the best malware. The other thing, I suppose, is to act as fast as you can to contain the damage. So the less people who see the passwords that are being leaked, the better. So as a consequence of all of these seemingly endless cyber breaches that we've been seeing in the news, it's been considered whether we should instigate a mandatory data breach notification scheme. So this basically means that an organisation has a responsibility to notify its customers, the Privacy Commissioner, and potentially the media in the result of a breach. So there's a couple of things that I think we need to think about in terms of this scheme before saying, yep, great idea. Obviously, the definition of harm is quite a difficult one. So currently they're talking about including things such as psychological, emotional, and reputational damage. So as actuaries, I think we can understand that's going to be very difficult to estimate. And there are other areas where we've seen psychological damages blow out, and potentially it's difficult to keep a lid on them. So that's going to be one to watch there. The statement that companies ought to be reasonably aware of a breach happening is also potentially problematic. There was a PwC research paper that found that it takes on average 243 days for a company to realise that it's been breached. So potentially that could be a bit of a problem because how long is the notification process going to be? I mean, do we expect people to detect things in a week, in a month, in a year? I'd say even a year is probably pushing it at this stage based on that stat. The other one is, again, with globalisation, the role of a service provider. So a lot of companies have partners, be they onshore or offshore, and the question of who is responsible in the case of a data breach is still one that I think bears some consideration. I think what's being said in the market at the moment is that if you have that relationship with the customer, regardless of whether it was breached through your own systems or somebody else's, you're responsible in that event for notifying, but that's still definitely up for debate. Notification fatigue. So are we going to get some people who are so worried about getting in trouble for not notifying that they notify every small little slip up, which in turn can also place a burden on the industry? So undoubtedly there would be increased costs of monitoring and notifying. Some other things that we also considered were potentially if you have a register of data breaches, you could end up with a lot more class actions and potentially ambulance chasing if the lawyers were able to get access to some of that information. And the other one, which I thought was probably a good part of this scheme, is that potentially it would reduce the moral hazard of insurers. So what we note with cyber risks is that often companies are very interconnected, and if a breach has happened in one company, it could well have happened in other connected companies. So as the insurer, if you know about one of those, what is your obligation to notify other potentially affected companies, which could end up costing you some money in a payout? So this is just one example of a cyber insurance product. So what I'd note is that cyber insurance should really form part of the overall cyber risk management framework of the company. So there are many different products out there, and they really do vary in terms of their offerings. So some of the services that are offered by insurers, depending on the level of cover, can include a joint risk assessment. So this is where you partner the insurer along with the company to really understand what type of risk the company is liable to suffer and how we want to start mitigating some of those risks. There could be a bespoke solution tailored to fill those gaps that are identified as well. So this is quite a flexible product, which I think fits with the fact that cyber insurance is very much not a one-size-fits-all type of risk. The one thing that I thought was really interesting was that you can get these cyber response teams that are either internally built up by the insurer or the insurer partners with other specialist teams, either onshore or offshore. And basically, in the event of a cyber breach, these event teams are on call 24/7. They get called up, there's been a breach, okay, let's get on it. So they get in there and they start to assess what's caused the loss. They start to try and mitigate it, shut it down, and really stop that from spreading. So I think that cyber is very much like a pandemic in some respects. The quicker that you get in there and shut it down, the better it is for all involved. So that's really an interesting way in which cyber is sort of shifting up the insurance game. Okay, so potential rating factors for cyber insurance. So I preface this by saying I think it would be really hard. So it's a very rapidly changing industry. You have very bespoke risks. How can you keep your underwriting up to date with the changing industry? I think that's a real challenge here. Having said that, we've had a go at some of the things that we would consider as important, those being grouped into industry, company-specific, and IT-specific. So in terms of industry, obviously the type of data held, whether it's sensitive or not, could be quite important. The reliance on technology in that particular field. And also, I think the fact that if you were to hack a particular company, it makes sense that other leveraged companies would also have more of an exposure. So any risk that you have is probably going to spread like wildfire through a connected industry. You can have company specific, so the good old rating factors of turnover, numbers of transactions, but I think what's different here is that with cyber insurance, it's all about how you protect your data and how quickly you can shut down a threat. So really staff training and your attitude and approach to risk management are really important rating factors here. In terms of the IT specific, you've obviously got your virtual security, but one thing some people tend to forget is the physical security. So it's no point spending X amount of dollars on a fantastic malware product if you leave a laptop lying around. The level of data encryption is keeping that up to date. How much data do you retain? Is it all useful or are you just keeping it for the sake of it? Outsourcing, so if you have companies that you're partnering with offshore, are their security going to be as up to date as yours? And again, the number of connected devices that you may have. So you're only as strong as your weakest link when it comes to cyber frameworks. Okay, so there are many implications for insurers, so I'll just summarise quickly the opportunities and on the converse side, the challenges that I can see emerging. So as I said, a very large potential market, and it's growing by the day. So it's a really good opportunity for insurers to start to branch out and get some new sources of premium. It allows you to build strong relationships with the business. So you're not just paying out, you're partnering with them to help them with their risk management and also to help them in the event of a crisis. You're really there trying to reduce their costs. It gives us a great opportunity to apply our ERM skills to other third parties outside of the insurance industry and really to drive and add value outside of the traditional insurance role. And it allows us to move up the value chain. So rather than just paying out at the end, we're able to become trusted advisors by partnering and offering strategic advice to our insurers. So the challenges, as I said, limited historical data, difficult to rate, and with a rapidly changing industry, is the past even an indication for the future anyway? It's global, continuously evolving. It needs to be bespoke. Also, building up adequate skills could be difficult. I mean, in the insurance industry, I would argue that we're probably not IT specialists. So how do you get that knowledge? I think it's either building it up internally, which is quite costly, or looking for opportunities to partner with other companies who already have those skill sets. And obviously, being very connected means that you have an ability for risks to spread like wildfire through a community. Okay, so now the Internet of Things is our third and final topic. So, if you're like me and not overly technologically advanced, I've kind of heard about the Internet of Things, but I didn't really know what it meant. So I'm going to try and explain it with this picture. So, imagine that you're standing in the supermarket and you're trying to remember if you needed milk or not, and you can't remember, and nobody's at home. So what could you do in that situation? I suppose with the Internet of Things, you could actually text your fridge and ask your fridge, do we have enough milk? And your fridge will actually respond. So the example here is actually LG Home Chat, which is something that they've devised that connects all of your appliances up together and to you. So all of them are able to interact. So this is an example where somebody was going to go on holiday, so they texted all their appliances to say that they were out of town. And some of their appliances texted back, saying various things such as, oh, you know, have a nice trip. Do you want me to shut down into power save mode? The vacuum cleaner is saying, hey, do you want me to give it a spin before you get home so you have a nice clean house? And I'm pretty sure somebody, one of the appliances said, hey, I'm going to miss you, which is a little bit strange, to be honest. But I think it just conveys the power of a connected universe. And as more and more things sort of get locked into the grid, I think that we're going to see an increasing amount of information and data that's being flowed through. And, you know, it's kind of nice that your appliances will miss you. So that's okay, so what are the implications for insurers of this interconnectedness? Yeah, that's 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon for those who don't know. So, as I said earlier, it only takes one weak link. Some people call it the Internet of Insecure Things, because obviously you don't have the best security on all of your devices, and the more that things are being linked up, the more chances there are for risks to occur. Security is key. As insurers, we're in the business of risk, we're in the business of loss. So we need to make sure that our insurance covers are up to date with the new world and the new risks that are emerging. There's heightened contagion risk. So if any one of those people on Kevin Bacon's map knows a piece of information, Chinese rumours it could get back to somebody else on that. So you can quickly see that contagion risk can spread through all of these connected devices very quickly. On the plus side, though, it does allow us to obtain richer and more accessible data. So all of these connected devices is constantly scraping information, putting out signals, and we're in a good position to take advantage of that. So I think at the moment they estimate that just under 15 billion devices are connected to the internet today, which is quite a lot. So to demonstrate the potential power of the Internet of Things and the sheer volume of data available to understand an individual's risk profile, we're going to play a quick game. My favourite. Guess who? Okay. So I'm going to read out a whole bunch of questions and then see if you can guess who I'm talking about. So they're female. She's 40. She was born in 75. She lives on Sunset Boulevard in California. She's a smoker. She owns 5 properties, 2 private jets, and 5 cars. So she's obviously doing very well for herself. Does anybody know who she is yet?
Cameron Diaz.
Oh, good guess, but no, sadly not. Could have been Cameron. I'm sure she has some private jets. So apart from her name, this is sort of roughly about as much information as insurers would generally know. So they know a little bit more, so about the construction type, model, make of cars, a bit about the security, but In a nutshell, that's kind of most of it. So, how much more information, though, does the internet know? So I'm just going to keep going with some questions. No, good one, but no. You may guess it pretty soon, though. She's a Goodwill UN ambassador, so definitely not Lindsay Lohan. But good guess. Angelina Jolie, yes, good guess. So other things you can know about Angelina is that she has a pilot's license, she collects knives and first edition books, she's had preventative double mastectomy due to an 87% risk of developing breast cancer, and she has six children. So well done. Okay, so it's Angelina. So as a pricing actuary or an underwriter, wouldn't you just love to get your hands on that second set of information? So I'd imagine that knowing that Angelina is a cancer risk, that she collects knives, and she's a pilot, and potentially she has six children, might make you consider her as slightly different risk than if you'd only known the first half of that information. So the key takeaway, I think, from this exercise is that, in my opinion, the Internet of Things is starting to erode insurer IP. So we've always prided ourselves on being able to understand risk with a limited amount of information and predict the future. But what happens if there is less uncertainty, if you have the information, if there's not as much need to predict the future? So I'd argue that technology companies are probably in a really good place to access a lot of that information and to start making really great guesses and assumptions in terms of premium prices. Okay, so I need to be a bit more positive than that. So how can we as insurers unlock the value in the Internet of Things? So the Internet of Things will create this connected universe, and I think that in doing so it will start to blur some of the boundaries between traditional industries and also communities. We might see some disintermediation of markets as people become more connected to different applications, devices, companies as well. So we need to be able to differentiate in order to stay relevant in this new world. How are we going to do that? Well, I think what we need to do is we need to anticipate. So we need to understand what's likely on the horizon and make sure that we're well positioned to take advantage of it. We need to be able to innovate, come up with new ideas, new ways to respond to the changing needs of our society. In doing so, we need to invest in R&D and infrastructure to allow ourselves to be able to not just anticipate changes, but make sure that we can execute them as well. Potentially partnering is one way to do that, so utilising the skill of other industries and other companies in a way that allows us to stay relevant. Connecting. So to me, I think this is the key to everything. So not just the Internet of Things needs to be connected, but we need to be connected into the Internet of Things and into the end users. So the key here is that if we can connect with people and provide trusted relationships and partnerships, then we're offering something more than just paying out a claim. We're offering a service and one that's valued. Okay, so Scott's going to sum up now.
We've condensed our recommendations down into three key items. First is to move up the value chain. So traditionally, insurers have only operated once they've been notified of a claim. That is, insurers have been reactive to their policyholders' needs and have not been proactive as yet across most policies. If you move one step up this chain, you move into risk mitigation. And this is becoming increasingly popular. So damage control from cyber attacks and incident response teams on standby in the context of cyber insurance are two examples. If you move up one step again, you move into risk engineering and risk prevention. And this has historically only been available on large commercial accounts. However, it is moving into the domestic space as well through, say, severe weather warning SMSs. We would argue that in order to survive in the new world, insurers need to move up this value chain. They need to partner with policyholder, partner with other industries. And if they are able to do this, it changes the value proposition of insurance. The second recommendation is an increased focus on customer service and innovation. So there's a need to re-examine the needs of individuals in a heavily technology-reliant and interconnected world. So cyber insurance provides a service offering, driverless cars in a world of car sharing, offer insurance for a journey, and Internet of Things. Leverage the additional information and insight you get from data if you indeed have access to that data. Secondly, focus on customer service. We've seen people love to rate their experiences, and the experiences of one person can be interpreted by thousands of other people. We've seen in Airbnb and Uber, they have disrupted traditional markets, not just on the basis of price, but also on the basis of a superior service or comparable service. So user ratings really are key here. In addition, we recommend insurers increase the level of trust. How would you go about doing this? Don't only contact someone when you want something. So have targeted communication with the customer in mind. And it's important to remember that the premium charge is only one component people consider when they come to purchase insurance. It's the reputation of the insurer, the ability to tailor products, and the experiences of others that dictate whether a customer will go with you. And our final recommendation is to consider risks at a global level. Look overseas when assessing the future direction of the industry in terms of the products offered, but also the competitors in the industry. So we saw in the car manufacturing space, technology companies are entering that domain. Insurers should do the same. They should look at disruptors overseas. Secondly, consider risks at a global level. For cyber insurance, risks can occur from anywhere around the globe and at any time. And in driverless cars, a lot of the technology is shared. So the claims experience in one country can be used to inform and make predictions of claims experience in another country. Look at judicial interpretation of fault and damages awarded. Fault in the context of driverless cars and damages surrounding cyber sort of data theft. And finally, consider the increased correlation between risks and cross products. And this has implications not just for insurers, but also reinsurers. And on that note, I'd like to open it up for questions and discussion. So please raise your hand and Donna will come around with the microphone.
What do you think the public's appetite is for driverless cars killing hundreds of people a day around the world?
I'm guessing not very high. So obviously it's quite a difficult moral dilemma. And I think that Scott alluded to that with his example as well, where the morals that are built into these Google cars have to end up being the morals that our society adopts. And that's quite difficult. And I think that, you know, in some respects, laws have done a job at trying to do that. So the way that we govern our society is, in some respects, a shared moral view of the world, obviously one that people don't generally always agree with, and not one that has such fatal implications, I suppose. So I think that that's one of the key things that needs to be sorted in the whole Google car debate, is around that moral problem. And I think that that's probably the hardest one to solve.
How do we convince them that while we're still trying to solve that, killing hundreds of people a day is better than killing thousands of people a day?
Yeah, and I think that hopefully data has got a role to play in that. So some of the analysis and the test runs that are being done do have stats coming out that help us to understand, for example, with the truck convoys, we've got the amount of fatalities being caused by truck accidents, which can be replaced by Google cars. So there can be some statistical work, I think, done to help support the arguments. I think that you always get some sensational examples that come out, and I think that that's really the challenge for the the Google car industry in general, is being able to cut down those sensational stories with facts.
Is that something actuaries can help with, do you think? How do you think we can help?
Yeah, definitely. I think that as actuaries, we're very well placed to analyse the data and to help to create some of those arguments, utilising some of the stats that have come out of the test so far, and also the information and the stats that we understand in the motor insurance industry at the moment. So I think it's definitely a key role that actuaries could play in that area.
So the Australian National Transport Commission is currently taking submissions for automated cars. So are you aware of any insurers which are providing submissions to this, or if not, do you think they should be?
I don't actually know the answer to this one, so if anyone in the audience does, feel free to pipe up. It's an interesting one to understand where insurers are going to sit on this. I think that it's still up for debate whether Google cars are good or bad for the insurance community. I think that there are some who are concerned about the erosion of traditional premiums, but there's definitely an opportunity for some insurers to get that first mover advantage and start to create different products, so the journey style products, more product liability style products. So I think that it's probably an interesting one to say whether insurers would jump at the chance to do that or not, and I think that it would help to differentiate some insurers from others potentially.
Yeah, I think insurers have a pretty good understanding of the risk surrounding sort of conventional motor vehicles, and I think they're able to add real value to the discussion, not just from, I guess, impact on the insurance industry, but impact on society in general. So, I mean, I think that in some senses, insurers are reactive to the environment, but there's also the potential for insurers to shape the environment. And I mean, I'm not aware of any insurers that are involved. I haven't read the paper, but I'd be surprised if there were not quite a few involved there.
Elaine Grace, I wanted to ask about the Internet of Things, and I guess whether you'd come across any timeframes and timelines of when you think it's kind of going to become, I guess, similar to your cars, and also just where are the leading innovators in that space, and are we seeing anywhere being integrated into insurance policies or risk management?
So I did find something in the research that said that while there's just under 15 billion devices connected today, they assume that it could end up being 1.5 trillion devices connected, and that's growing fairly rapidly. So from the research I saw, the amount of devices that were connected up has just grown in leaps and bounds over the last sort of 5 to 10 years. So I think it's definitely quickly developing. I don't think that we know exactly how it's going to impact on the insurance landscape, because obviously the Internet of Things is sort of a broad encompassing term for a lot of different things. So I'd argue that Google cars are part of the Internet of Things, that cyber insurance is part of the Internet of Things. I guess the question is, what is the next Internet of Things? And that's probably a hard one to pick, but certainly if we could pick it, it would be fantastic, because you could start to develop a niche there. So I think Scott and I were joking, what happens if all your devices and all of your appliances at home attack you, you know? So really, if everything's connected up, it's going to create new risks that we're probably not even cognizant of yet.
And it would reduce your need for house insurance premium.
Exactly. So, you know, the devices and appliances could start attacking intruders. I don't know. But it certainly is something that I think that we need to spend more time thinking about, because we don't really. I mean, at the moment we're dealing with the risks that we know about, which are Google cars and cyber, but yeah, what's the next big thing that the tech industry is going to come out with, and then what's the corresponding risk and loss that we want to insure against? I don't know what it would be, but I think it's in following the tech companies that we're probably going to get our first indications, and following them on a global scale.
Alan Merton's my name. I'll go back to the previous question. I'm not an authority on it, and I don't know whether insurers are responding either. But thanks for your presentation. I've got a whole range of thoughts going through my head, but one that, coming back to your comment that insurers should be well placed to help on some of these questions on, for example, driverless cars, I think it's worth reminding ourselves that insurance has always been a facilitator of industry. So if you go back to Lloyd's Coffee Shop, we allowed marine transportation because insurers actually helped that process. And you know, more recent examples, it's been insurers that talked to the government in Australia the issues over flood and building in flood zones. The driverless cars, a huge issue around them is not the car technology, but the infrastructure. So the changing of the roads to actually suit driverless cars as opposed to traffic lights and roundabouts to suit drivers. So that does strike me as a scenario where insurers can step up and say there are a whole lot of advantages, but to make it work, there's got to be a whole lot of change. The thing that I think you were indicating earlier, though, that comes out of all of this is, as Elaine just said, what happens to domestic car insurance and domestic home insurance, which the premiums could shrink dramatically. And suddenly the biggest issue around all of these things for the insurance industry is we're doing the right thing, reducing risk for consumers. That means less insurance, which by nature means we have to be far better at managing the expenses of running insurance business because we don't have a 30% loading for premiums on premiums for costs of providing insurance.
That's a really good point, and also I liked the reminder of the Lloyd's coffee shop. I think that part of what we were arguing as well was that you're going to see that reduction in the traditional role of the insurer, and if we continue to try and do things the way we've always done them in writing motor insurance as we've always done them, and yet we advocate for Google cars, we're kind of, you know, in some respects writing our own death warrant. So it's really about if we are doing the right thing by society and putting some of these arguments forward, how are we going to reinvigorate ourselves as an insurance industry? And I think some of those keys were in terms of providing value propositions that exist outside of just the payment of claims. So seeing ourselves as trusted risk advisors, I think, is one of the keys that we were sort of going on about, I suppose, in parts of the presentation. So moving up that value chain to add advice and be those trusted advisors as opposed to claims payers, I think, is the only way that we can really start to innovate outside of the traditional realms of insurance, and then provide further advice, mitigation, and potentially loss cover for some of those new emerging products that come out of the Internet of Things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. In the context of driverless cars, though, as well, I think what you might see is a shift in where the premium falls. For example, product liability cover could potentially respond to that, whether you'll see a, you know, one-to-one correspondence. Unlikely if driverless cars sort of reduce accident frequency, but it will be offsets elsewhere, and I guess it's just understanding where those offsets are and looking for new opportunities that emerge as a result of the change as well.
Thanks for the presentation, guys. I thought it was great. Just looking at the Internet of Things and just taking in wearables as well, which is probably something that wasn't really touched on, but has already kind of proliferated the insurance industry globally. I'm just kind of taking the angle of, in the future and currently, we're seeing different lines of insurance blend together when they've all got different regulatory measures. So we're already seeing health and life go together, which operate under two completely separate regulatory environments globally and domestically. A couple of insurers domestically forecasted blending together or packaging in home and motor with health, and things like small business with workers' compensation, health and wellbeing. From an actuarial point of view, does that make the risk rating even tougher going forward, considering all the regulatory bounds, or does that make it easier, then you have more information on the policyholders?
I think that's a really good question, and I agree with your comment that there's the real potential to blur the boundaries between insurance products. And I guess the extent to which that is feasible depends on the appetite within a company to offer that holistic product. In terms of whether that makes it easier or not for the insurer, having all that data available, that's really difficult to answer. I think
What we are seeing, though, is that it is moving away from risk sharing and cross-subsidizing to a pretty accurate picture of an individual's risk profile. And the extent to which we as a society may want that may vary. So whilst I can see in some classes there being natural appeal to understanding everything that there is to know about an individual, if you were offering, say, life insurance and you knew certain characteristics about a potential policyholder, whether that would be in society's interest to bump up their premium considerably is another question. So I know I haven't answered your question, but that's sort of my thoughts on it.
You touched on Internet of Things and the possibility of fridges attacking you and all the rest and cyber risks. Has any thought been given to sophisticating personalised products, which are generally for retail customers, and what the challenges are there in managing products that need to be more sophisticated for more sophisticated risks, but also keeping in a way that customers can understand and build that trust where you're not declining things that they don't understand?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question and a difficult one as well. So obviously the push for insurers has been to automate what is simple. That gives great cost savings, ease of transaction. When you're introducing more sophisticated and difficult risks, you obviously can't automate that as easily as you otherwise could. And potentially the infrastructure has to be quite different because you need to assess bespoke needs going forward. So I think that that's a really good question, one that I hadn't considered. But it could definitely change the operating model because the push previously has all been bring costs down, we've got a bespoke product. And then if you're moving to something that requires a lot more underwriting knowledge and intervention, then that operating model would have to shift. And that's a really good point, one I hadn't considered.
I guess I just wanted to let everybody know that the Actuaries Institute is doing a white paper on disruption, on the insurance and on many of the topics we discussed today. I guess I'd just again like to congratulate you two, you know, and it's great to look around and just see so many young people engaged in this topic and, you know, and I guess I'd encourage you to do more, you know, brainstorming on these ideas, get your names out there as actuaries thinking about the future because that's how we can really get a role in this space. So it's just... it's great to see everybody here. Thank you. And watch out for our paper in a couple of months.
On that note, without any further questions, I would like to thank Jenna and Scott for their time today in sharing their thoughts on digital disruption. And I hope you all have gained further insight on what the future marketplace can hold. So thank you all for coming.